Mark chapter 10, beginning at verse 35. And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came up to him and said to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." And he said to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Grant us to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left, in your glory." Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized?" And they said to him, "We are able." And Jesus said to them, "The cup that I drink, you will drink, and with the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand or at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared." And when the 10 heard it, they began to be indignant at James and John. And Jesus called them to him and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many."
George Orwell is most famous for his novels, Animal Farm, 1984, I'm sure you've read. But he also wrote essays. And one of the essays he wrote is titled, "Why I Write." And Orwell said that there are four great motives for writing. And number one, he said, is, quote, "sheer egoism, desire to seem clever, to be talked about, to be remembered after your death." He said writers share this characteristic with scientists, artists, politicians, lawyers, soldiers, successful businessmen, in short, with the whole top crust of humanity. Well, it's pretty honest, isn't it? And, well, he certainly achieved his goal in terms of being remembered. He's remembered 65 years after his death, so much that even the name of the international reality TV franchise, Big Brother, is an acknowledgement of the influence that he had. Why I write. If Jesus Christ had written an essay, not "Why I Write," but "Why I Came," what reasons do you think he would have given? As it happens, Jesus himself never wrote a thing, as far as we're aware. No book, not even an essay, as far as we know. But this gospel writer, Mark, he records Jesus' words, in which Jesus tells us why he came. And it wasn't to get glory for himself, and it wasn't to make a name for himself, and it wasn't to be remembered after his death, though he obviously is. It was to give, and it was to serve. So in the last verse of the reading we've just had, Mark 10, verse 45, Jesus said, speaking of himself, "The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." So he came not to get, but to give. And he came not to be served, but to serve. Firstly, then, Jesus came to give, but to give what? For Christmas and for birthdays, people often write lists, don't they, of what they want. And I don't know about you, but it's something I always struggle with. I just haven't a clue what I want. And I'm always struggling to come up with some list. And here I am, I'm coming up to another birthday later this month. April 26th, just in case. Nothing big required. Just I'm going to have to write this wish list again. And, you know, once again, I'm stuck for ideas. Imagine if the whole human race had to write a wish list. I wonder what we would put on there. If God said, "Look, I'm going to give you a gift. You write a wish list." What would we as a human race put on? I guess there'd be pretty obvious contenders, things like world peace, happiness, poverty being history, and so on, all good things. But when Jesus came into the world, he didn't ask us for our wish list. He knew what we needed better than we know ourselves. He had no doubt at all what gift he was going to give. He says, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus came to give the ultimate gift, the gift of himself, to give his life for us, to lay down his perfect life in death on the cross. Last weekend, we celebrated Easter. And Easter is it's a bit dwarfed, isn't it, by Christmas. So Christmas is seen as the big thing, the big celebration by most people in our culture. But Easter is actually the big event. So the reason for Christmas is Easter. In fact, Christmas really just gets the main player onto the stage. But Easter is where the action happens. Jesus came into the world that first Christmas to give his life that first Easter. He came, he said, to give his life. So the point of the cradle was the cross. I went past a hoarding on a bus shelter with a Boots ad on it, as in Boots the shop. And the slogan on there said, give a gift that is as special as the one you're giving it to. So give a gift that is as special as the one you're giving it to. And it had a picture of a hairdryer. Now, I don't know about you, but I would be slightly disappointed if somebody thought I was as special as a hairdryer. And it doesn't matter what accessories and how fancy it is. I'd rather hope to be a bit more special than that, sort of worth a bit more than a hairdryer. How special we must be to God, all those sinners, for Jesus to give his life for us. Richard Dawkins caused bit of a stir last year when a woman asked him what she should do if she discovered that she was pregnant with a child with Down syndrome. And Dawkins' famous tweeted reply was, abort it and try again. And he went on to point out that his argument is a perfectly rational response from his atheistic perspective. And it is. If there is no God, if we're just electrochemical machines or naked apes, if we're nothing more than that, we have no ultimate value. None of us have, whether or not we've got disabilities. We're nothing special. But Easter says otherwise. Easter says you are not just a few chemicals in a bag of skin. You're so special, albeit a sinner, that Jesus came into the world to give his life for you. Now, how does Jesus giving his life actually help us? If you were up on the observation deck of the Shard, I don't know if you've been up there, I haven't. Anyone been up on the observation? Okay, if you were up on the observation deck of the Shard and looking at the view, and suddenly some stranger came up to you and tapped me on the shoulder and said, I'm going to show you how special you are to me. And with those words went and leapt off the observation deck to his death, you'd be a bit puzzled, to say the least. Now, I'm sure you can't actually do that off the observation deck. But anyway, how does Jesus giving his life, how does it actually help us at all? Well, look at what Jesus says. He says there in verse 45, he came to give his life as a ransom. By this stage in Mark's gospel account, Jesus has predicted three times his death in Jerusalem. But now he tells us why he's going to die. He says he would give his life as a ransom for many. What is a ransom? Well, a ransom is a payment given to set somebody free. The other month, tragically, two hostages were being held by Al-Qaeda militants in Yemen. And they were killed in a failed rescue attempt by the US and Yemeni special forces. And we read these sort of accounts, and our heart goes out to the families of these people and to others who are still in captivity. And I guess it makes us very thankful that we are not in that sort of situation ourselves. But the Bible says that actually we are. That as human beings, spiritually, we have been taken captive. We're spiritual hostages. We're held captive by sin and guilt and death and the devil. We're bound, it says, in the kingdom of darkness. But in Jesus, God has come to the rescue. And he hasn't sent in the special forces to take life. He sent his son to give his life as a ransom payment to secure our release. He paid the penalty that was ours for going our own way instead of God's way. Some of you, no doubt, are into Homeland, the US TV series about the war on terror. And Saul, the former director of the CIA, in one episode, he's taken hostage by the Taliban. And to secure his freedom, they arranged for a prisoner exchange, that Saul would be set free in exchange for 5 senior Taliban prisoners. And I won't tell you the outcome, just in case you're working your way through the box set and you don't know how that turns out. But it sort of raises a question, how can one man be exchanged for 5 others? And the answer is, it's because of who he is. It's because of who he is. So Saul is not just anyone. Saul is the former director of the CIA. He's worth a lot. And so his one life can be exchanged for 5 others. If the former director of the CIA is worth 5 others, how many do you think the Son of God might be worth? How many people could he set free through giving his life? Well, an infinite number. And Jesus said he came to give his life as a ransom for many. And we're not told how many, but many. A countless multitude, we learn elsewhere, like the stars of the sky and like the sand on the seashore. All those who will receive him. Are you among the many? Jesus came to give his life for us, to set us free from this captivity to sin and guilt, from our captivity to death and judgment, and from the kingdom of darkness. But to be set free, we need to receive this gift ourselves. If we're going to be set free, we have to receive the gift ourselves. Some years ago, my long-suffering wife bought me a jigsaw. Not the 1,000-piece variety, but the power tool machine variety that you plug in to the mains. I have not had any benefit from it at all, done me no good whatsoever. But that is my fault, not hers. So it's in my study, lying unopened. It's still in its box. It's still in its little cellophane wrapper. A gift needs receiving, needs opening, if we are going to benefit. And so Jesus says he came to give his life for us, but we need to receive the gift. We need to open it. We need to use it. We need to say, thank you for giving your life for me to set me free. But if we have done that, if we've received Jesus' gift of his life laid down for us, where do you go from there? So what is life like beyond that? Well, having received his life, we are to live his life. So in giving his life, he came to serve, and he says that we are to be like him. So if you have a look at verse 44, he says, whoever would be great among you must be the slave of all, for even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. There was a video on the BBC News website of a kung fu fan from Kabul, and he's being hailed as Afghanistan's answer to Bruce Lee. And in an interview with him, he said, Bruce Lee was my hero when I was growing up. I used to dream about him. I think he was a role model. I may not be Bruce Lee, but I'll follow his footsteps as long as I live. It's rousing stuff. Well, disciples of Jesus are to have this same commitment to following the Master and to being like him. Not looking like him or fighting like him, but serving like him. We are to serve like him. What will that involve? Well, I put 3 things on the sheet from these verses. Firstly, not glory seeking, but humbly serving. If you look in verse 36, James and John, 2 of the disciples, had come up to Jesus with a pretty cheeky request. So verse 36, they say, teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. Grant us to sit, one at your right hand, one at your left, in your glory. They knew that Jesus was going to establish his kingdom, and so they put in an early bid for the key positions in the cabinet in the new government. They wanted glory. They wanted to be the greatest. They wanted to be top dog, to be number one, to be the best. It's all me first. When the other 10 disciples hear about this, they're not best pleased. Verse 41 says, when the 10 heard about it, they began to be indignant at James and John. Why were they indignant? Well, obviously, because they wanted to be first instead. And who doesn't? Doesn't something of this selfish ambition infect all of us? the time of Jesus, there were copper coins in circulation, which had on them the head of Augustus, who was the reigning Roman emperor. And on these coins it had his head and it had his name, and it had the inscription, "He who deserves adoration." He who deserves adoration. And isn't there something in each of us that wants those words over our head? And we want to be praised. We want to be well thought of. We want our name there and our reputation in neon lights. Remember George Orwell's reason for writing? Sheer egoism. And that's very honest, but it's also very uncomfortable, isn't it? Because we may well recognize the same tendency in ourselves. But that is not the Jesus way. Even Jesus said, even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. If anyone deserved glory, it was him, it was Jesus. So the Son of Man, this title he uses, is an Old Testament title for a person whom God would send, whom he would appoint one day to rule over everything and rule over everyone. And so if anyone deserves to be served, it was him. And Jesus said this was him. He was this Son of Man figure. But he came to serve. And at one point, you'll remember, he even got down and he washed his disciples' feet and he did the job of a menial slave. The Bible says elsewhere of Jesus that though he was in the form of God, he didn't count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he made himself nothing, taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. And so Jesus says in verse 43, "Whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all." What would your workplace be like if everyone was living this out? You ever wondered that? What would your workplace be like if you went in tomorrow morning and everybody was living out this sort of humble service? So coming in each day to serve other people, not jostling for position and promotion, not trying to get glory for themselves, but purely serving. Someone told me the other day about a colleague of theirs who did a brilliant piece of work, so an outstanding bit of analysis in one of the banks here. And their boss took this report and put her own name on it and emailed it round the senior management. Selfish ambition, glory seeking. Now, you can't change your company, but we can begin with ourselves in changing ourselves. Secondly, not power grabbing, but sacrificially serving. Verse 42, Jesus said, "You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them." Well, it's very true to life, isn't it? So often those with power, they use it for themselves. They use it for their own benefit. They misuse power to abuse and to manipulate other people. But that is not the Jesus way. Jesus says in verse 43, "But it shall not be so among you," because it wasn't so with him. As the Son of Man, Jesus had unlimited power. But he came to serve. He didn't throw his weight around. Instead, he let others throw him around and nail him to a cross. Instead of wielding power, he suffered in weakness. One Christian minister wrote the following about a young man called James, whom he knew during his college years. And he wrote of this guy, "Before he became a Christian, he was a notorious womanizer. So James's pattern was to seduce a woman, and once he had had sex with her, lose interest and move on. When he professed faith in Christ, he quickly renounced his sexual escapades and he became active in Christian ministry. But in every class or study, he was argumentative and dominating. And in every meeting, he had to be the leader, even if he wasn't designated to be so. He was abrasive, he was harsh. And eventually it became clear that his meaning and value in life was still based in having power over others. That is what made him feel alive. So you see, it wasn't about sex at all. It was about power. But the minister goes on to observe that this desire to exercise power is not only for the powerful. He writes, you can pursue power in small, petty ways by becoming a local neighbourhood bully or a low-level bureaucrat who bosses around the few people in his field of authority. Do you recognise any of those traits in your own life? Maybe your own social life, church life, your own work life, your own heart? This tendency to use people rather than to serve people. Jesus said, it shall not be so among you. And thirdly and lastly, not kingdom comfort, but costly service. James and John's request to sit on thrones and rule was partly because they thought it would mean a life of privilege and a life of comfort, with other people serving them and responding to their every need. Kim Jong-un, the dictator ruling North Korea at the moment, he's the subject of that controversial film, The Interview. Kim was named as the 46th most powerful person in the world in the Forbes list a couple of years ago. And someone who visited him described their trip to his private island. They said, it's like Hawaii or Ibiza, but he's the only one who lives there. Meanwhile, the poor people of North Korea are dying of starvation in their thousands. His wife was photographed holding a handbag, which is worth an average year's salary in that country. And it is an extreme example, isn't it, of ruling to feather your own nest. And it is a long, long way from home. But the basic dynamic of wanting a comfortable life with other people serving me is maybe not so far from home. But that is not the Jesus way. Jesus said, even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. And that little word, even, is telling, isn't it? Even the Son of Man. That as Son of Man, Jesus is King of Kings, Lord of Lords. If anyone had the right to live in luxury, with people dropping grapes in his mouth, it was him. But he wasn't born in a palace with servants, but in a stable with animals. And he didn't wear a crown and royal robes, but simple clothes and a crown of thorns. And he didn't live in luxury, but poverty, having nothing to his name when he died apart from the clothes that he was wearing. His life wasn't one of comfort with other people serving him. It was one of sacrifice with him serving others. And he calls us to follow in his footsteps. In fact, in verse 39, he warns his disciples that following him would involve cost, not comfort. He's saying that serving would involve suffering, and he uses these images of drinking the cup of suffering and undergoing the baptism of trials. What would that service of others look like in your own life? Maybe in your own home, with your friends, in your marriage, in your family. So putting their needs first. Not waiting for others to serve me, but taking the initiative in serving them. I was lying in bed late one night, and my wife was sitting next to me working out a menu for a dinner the next day for 16 people that she was cooking. And she said, as I was sort of dozing there, she said, I could really do with Mary Berry's Christmas recipe book, but, you know, it's downstairs and I couldn't be bothered getting out of bed. I thought, oh, no, don't believe it, you know, because I've been prepping this talk. Jesus' words were on my mind. And my conscience was pricking me. I said, serve others. Don't choose comforts. Serve even when it's costly. Oh, good. No, no, no. And so I said, okay, I'll get it for you. I left the warmth of the duvet to go and hunt for this wretched recipe book for her. And when I came back clutching this thing, the fact that she was so pleasantly surprised gives you some idea that it wouldn't have been my normal instinctive response, let's say, in that situation. You know, we're all on a learning curve. Now, sacrificing the warmth of your duvet to get a recipe book is hardly the sort of ultimate example, is it, of giving up comfort for costly service. But it is a practical example, and that's the point. That this has to hit the ground in the nitty-gritty of our everyday lives. Who is going to do that task at work that nobody else wants to do? Who is going to help that friend in trouble when time is so pressured? Who is going to take out the rubbish when you're exhausted? If serving doesn't begin there, where is it going to begin? The kingdom, the power, the glory, by rights belong to Jesus, but he came into the world not to be served, but to serve, and he calls us to follow in his steps. I overheard an exchange the other day between some children, who will remain anonymous, which went, "Could you pick that up off the floor for me?" And the response was, "Do it yourself. Who do you think I am? Your servant?" You never said that yourself. I certainly said that. But the point is that we are to be servants of one another. And if that wasn't beneath the Son of Man, then it certainly isn't beneath any of us. Well, this Afghan Bruce Lee fan has shot to social media fame, partly because he actually looks very much like his hero, Bruce Lee. And he's posted some pictures of himself next to the martial arts legend. When people see us as followers of Jesus, it should remind them of Jesus. So when they see our humble, sacrificial, costly serving, it should make people think, "You remind me of somebody." Jesus came to give his life as a ransom for us. And that is a gift we need to receive and we need to say thank you for. And Jesus came to serve, and that is a model that we then need to follow. And this week after Easter is a great time for making sure that we are on the receiving end of Jesus' giving and on the serving end in our living. And if we are doing that, to persevere in doing it, as Galatians 6 verse 10 says, not to grow weary in doing good, for in due season we will reap if we do not give up. Well, we're going to pause now for a minute or so of quiet to reflect on this passage and what we've heard, and to pray in the quietness of our own minds and hearts. And then when the music starts, we're going to stand and sing a song which is all about service, laying our all before the King of Kings, and living to serve him.